Robert Mueller testifies tomorrow on Capitol Hill. His focus? Foreign meddling in the 2016 elections. Today on The World, we focus on 2020 and new efforts to stop Russian hackers from interfering with the vote.
You know, I think there are a number of small positive steps, but there's much, much more we can do.
Plus, we ask one local election official what his state is doing about this ongoing cyber threat.
If I tell you what we're doing precisely to secure elections, I am therefore making elections less secure.
Yeah, but he tells us anyway. And is Jimi Hendrix to blame or thank for London's wild parakeets?
He is rumored to have released a breeding pair of ringneck parakeets, and that's where the whole thing started.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and much more coming right up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Former special counsel Robert Mueller heads to Capitol Hill tomorrow, not by choice, but because he's been subpoenaed to testify before two House committees. Cue the political grandstanding.
This may be some of the most highly anticipated testimony that we've seen.
Lawmakers are intensely preparing for the most anticipated
hearing. Former special counsel Robert Mueller's highly anticipated testimony.
Everything's on the line for many of these congressional Democrats who know that this will determine whether they move toward impeachment.
Republicans believe that they could poke holes in Bob Mueller's credibility.
Yes, so highly anticipated. A lot of tomorrow's hearings are expected to focus on President Trump's links to Russia and whether he obstructed justice during Mueller's investigation. But don't get distracted by the spectacle, because there's another key issue Mueller detailed in his report. It's that Russia interfered in the 2016 U.S. presidential election and will keep doing so in the future. On the only occasion that Mueller has spoken publicly about his investigation, that was a point he underscored.
There were multiple systematic efforts to interfere in our election. And that allegation deserves the attention of every American.
So what election security lessons have we learned from 2016? And what are we doing to stop foreign meddling in 2020? We begin with those questions today on the show and with Jessica Brandt. She's with the Alliance for Securing Democracy, an organization that tries to prevent foreign meddling in U.S. and European elections. She says Russia's 2016 meddling was an attack on two fronts.
The first was a social media campaign that pushed content that was designed to polarize and mislead. And the second was a set of hacking operations that targeted election infrastructure, including state board of elections, county governments. And we also know that Russians succeeded at intruding in two Florida county election systems.
We're going to be actually speaking with a Florida official about their concerns. But precisely what kind of things are federal and state officials doing to hack-proof the next election?
Yeah. So, I think there are a number of small positive steps. We know that DHS stood up task forces around the midterms on countering foreign interference, on election security. There have been a number of measures introduced in Congress, including on a bipartisan basis, that would give more money to the states. The Secure Elections Act is one of them, but none of those things have become law. I'm particularly encouraged that last week, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, they basically set up a new role for an executive in charge of election threats and asked all the relevant intel agencies to identify a senior lead. I just see that as a really important move that will help with, you know, prioritizing this threat and improving coordination across the government. But I think the problem is that this doesn't totally add up to a coordinated strategy.
I mean, it is not hyperbole to say that democracy is at stake here if this is not secured. Why did the Secure Election Act not pass?
You know, I think on both sides of the aisle, our leaders are guilty of politically expedient messaging. And I think that's a shame, because we know that one of Russia's goals was to amplify polarization in our society.
And your organization, the Alliance for Securing Democracy, I mean, you work to prevent electoral interference. What is not being done that you would like to see?
You know, I want to make sure that there are clear protocols for information sharing about threats that are, you know, between levels of government and also across government. And then also that we tighten up our public messaging about election threats. I mean, I think the Florida case is in a way a case in point, that without effective public messaging, you know, we risk undermining public confidence in our elections. And if we do that, you know, we're at risk of doing Russia's work for it.
And on that first point, there is tension between the investigating body into election hacking, the FBI, and the voting infrastructure body, DHS. I'm reminded of the tension between the FBI and the CIA that led to the intelligence failures prior to 9/11. Do you think the lack of cooperation between the FBI and DHS could increase the likelihood of a dramatic hack like 2016?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, the FBI has a role and it's investigating intrusions into our election systems, and they operate under principles of investigatory secrecy, as is their, that's their as a matter of course, and that's important. But DHS has an important resilience building function, and that requires, you know, sharing information with the public, also with these private vendors that are involved in administering our elections. So in a sense, that tension is inherent, and that's why we need, you know, folks like a counter foreign interference coordinator, for example, at the NSC that can coordinate the interagency to make sure that these threats don't fall within gaps and seams.
But you're saying that is not happening right now.
I think, again, this move by the Director of National Intelligence last week is a positive step, but there's much, much more we can do. We still need to make sure that there are more resources, not just money, but expertise that gets to the states, because states actually run our elections. We should remember that this is not just about 2020, but 2022, 2024, that the threat is evolving. And we need to make sure that we are, you know, taking a whole of government approach here.
Jessica Brandt with the Alliance for Securing Democracy, speaking with us from Washington. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Florida is a swing state with a lot of electoral college votes. That makes it a big target for anyone wanting to disrupt U.S. elections. As we just heard, Florida was one of the states targeted in 2016. Russian government hackers got into voter registration databases in two Florida counties. But as far as officials can tell, no vote tallies or voter information was tampered with. What about next time, though? The problem of keeping hackers out of election systems is all-consuming for Paul Lux.
You know, we have a lot of different things that are going on, much of which we cannot talk about for quite obvious reasons. If I tell you what we're doing precisely to secure elections, I am therefore making elections less secure by publicly putting that information out.
Lux oversees elections in Florida's Okaloosa County. We wanted to hear what Lux learned from 2016 and how he's preparing for 2020. One step in safeguarding Florida's election networks and systems, getting all of the state's counties on the same intrusion detection system.
When all of the data from all 67 counties is being reported to the same source, and that source says, whoa, hold on a minute, IP address 1234 tried to hit 12 counties in the Florida panhandle all within 5 minutes of each other. Now we have an event people need to be paying attention to, and we can send out alerts, we can make phone calls, and we can say, everybody be on the alert, do this, do that, to make sure your systems aren't being compromised.
And when systems are compromised, the Department of Homeland Security tells government and election officials how it happened. All of Florida's counties have been signed up for that alert system for about a year.
We receive anonymized information that tells us things like, this happened in a county we're not going to name at the county government level, and this is how the attackers got in, and this is what the attackers did, and this is how you stop it from happening to you.
None of this is rocket science, but Lux says all of these efforts keep cybersecurity top of mind for local election officials, even for the not-so-tech savvy. There is one thing when it comes to election security that Lux says could be improved. He wants federal agencies to figure out a way to share classified information with election officials.
So I'm not saying I need to be on the president's security briefing every morning, because that's way above my pay grade. But when something is happening to the elections world, when counties are being compromised in Florida, it would be nice for us to be on the receiving end of those notifications specifically, so that we would know if we needed to take action, what our best steps were beyond the anonymous notifications that we're getting.
That was Paul Lux, supervisor of elections in Florida's Okaloosa County, on the front lines of election security, telling us how his state is trying to prevent foreign and domestic hacking in the 2020 election. Robert Mueller testifies tomorrow before Congress about his report into Russian election meddling. High above the Sea of Japan today, hostile fighter planes were having a Top Gun moment. Russian and Chinese warplanes flew repeatedly through disputed airspace, and that prompted both South Korea and Japan to scramble their own fighter jets. A South Korean plane even opened fire, blasting hundreds of warning shots to ward off a Russian A-50 surveillance plane. I asked the world's East Asia correspondent, Patrick Nguyen, exactly what happened.
It's all still a bit mysterious, but there is an island between South Korea and Japan that is claimed by both countries, has been in dispute for more than a century. Russian and Chinese aircraft came close to that island, South Korea scrambled planes, fired flares and warning shots at one of the Russian aircraft. The Russians said, "What are you doing? We are in international waters." The South Koreans said, "You're coming close to our island." Japan popped up and said, "Wait, no, actually, that's our island. We should have defended it." So it's four countries at play here. No one really knows exactly what happened at this point. There's just a lot of confusion.
Meanwhile, the two U.S. allies in the region, Japan and South Korea, are themselves at loggerheads in an increasingly bitter trade dispute. Japan has stopped exporting high-tech materials to South Korea, a blow to Seoul's tech industry. That followed South Korea's insistence that Japan make up for historic grievances. The world's Patrick Wynn again.
So this goes way back as well. Korea was ruled by the Japanese Empire from 1910 to 1945. Brutal things did happen. Forced labor, sexual slavery, which Japan calls comfort women. Many South Koreans say Japan hasn't done enough to pay them back or to apologize. So the way that anger is being expressed now is you have former comfort women pursuing legal action. You have a boycott Japanese products campaign. And the more inflammatory side, a local district in South Korea wanted to put stickers on any Japanese-made products that were going into their school system to say, this product was made by war criminals.
Why is this happening now?
Well, right now, South Korea is run by President Moon Jae-in, and he's running a left-of-center government. And in South Korea, anti-Japanese sentiment is associated with the left, which is kind of strange because you might think hyper-nationalism would be a right-wing thing. So whenever there is a left-of-center government, these feelings become emboldened and come to the fore, and Japan is frankly sick of it.
So how's Japan reacting to Moon Jae-in's agenda?
Well, it's a little technical, but it's a very harsh reaction. Japan is saying, we're not going to send you these chemicals you need to make your gadgets. South Korea is all about gadgets. Samsung, right? Mm. If South Korea can't make its gadgets, it can't power its export-driven economy. So while that seems like a very niche thing, chemicals, semiconductors, it actually is a really serious blow to South Korea.
South Korea is that dependent on Japan?
For these niche chemicals, yes, and it's really hard to stockpile some of them because they are so toxic and inflammatory. So you can't just stockpile a ton of it in a warehouse. You need to keep the supply chain running. So that can actually hurt South Korea. I talked to a professor, Robert Kelly, at Pusan National University and asked him how he thinks this is going to play out.
The South Koreans are going to freak because you're going to get basically a competition inside South Korea between the left's desire to sort of like bang away at the anti-Japanese drum and the corporate saying the economy is going to suffer unless you figure this thing out. And that's why it's actually going to be a really fascinating test of what is more important in South Korea, right? The fetishization of export or anti-Japanese nationalism. That is the big fight in South Korea in the next 4 or 5 months, and the Americans can't arbitrate that.
So Robert Kelly says the Americans don't have a role here, but the U.S. is getting involved, and President Trump has sent John Bolton, his national security advisor, to South Korea to help defuse tensions. I mean, we don't typically think John Bolton and mediator in the same breath. What do experts think? Could Bolton make a difference?
I think that the odds are against him. The White House just hasn't worked very hard to maintain these relationships at a very deep level in East Asia. I mean, Trump famously has allowed the State Department to be gutted. You don't have this deep bench of diplomats who can come in and pull on these relationships to make things happen. John Bolton has become a known quantity in South Korea. The South Korean administration doesn't like him at all. Moon Jae-in probably will smile and shake his hand and it'll all look smooth on the surface, but they're fundamentally at odds. The South Korean government under Moon Jae-in has been very dovish. They are pushing for peace with North Korea. John Bolton is, and I think I can say this, you know, without any bias, he agitates for war. So he's a very inflammatory figure on that peninsula.
The world's Patrick Wynn. We'll leave it there. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
The UK has a new prime minister. Everything you need to know about Boris Johnson, that's next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. British politics has been full of surprises lately. Brexit, upstart new political parties, and big defeats in Parliament for the government. But today's news about who will be the next prime minister of the UK had a sense of the inevitable.
And therefore I give notice that Boris Johnson is elected as the leader of the Conservative and Unionist Party.
So Boris Johnson has beaten his opponent, Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt, to lead the Conservative Party and replace outgoing Prime Minister Theresa May. Now, though, comes the hard part. Can Johnson keep his party and the country together as he tries to steer Britain out of the European Union? From London, here's the world's Orla Barry.
His victory speech was classic Boris Johnson, upbeat and optimistic.
I say to all the doubters, we are going to energise the country. We're going to get Brexit done in a new spirit of can-do. We are going to unite this amazing country and we are going to take it forward. I thank you all very much.
Johnson also needs to unite his Conservative Party, which won't be easy. Just shortly before the announcement of his win, there came the news that the Education Secretary would be resigning. This follows the pledge by three other cabinet members that they will step down when Johnson takes office. Boris Johnson's challenge now is to fulfil his vow to deliver Brexit before October 31st. There are many in the centre-right news media who don't think he can do it. Here's the Financial Times political editor, George Parker.
I think it's hard to see how he delivers Brexit. If he doesn't succeed, there are a lot of people in the Conservative Party who will be lining up to bring him down. And he could go down as one of the worst and shortest-lived British Prime Ministers in recent times.
But Johnson today rebuffed the newspaper's pessimism.
I read in my Financial Times this morning that there are no incoming leader. No incoming leader has ever faced such a daunting set of circumstances, it said. Well, I look at you this morning and I ask myself, do you look daunted? Do you feel daunted? I don't think you look remotely daunted.
European leaders have offered their congratulations. Among them, incoming European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, who will be at the heart of the upcoming Brexit negotiations.
I'm looking forward to have a good working relation with him. There are many different and difficult issues to tackle together. We have challenging times ahead of us.
On the streets of London this afternoon, the mood was more downbeat.
I think it's just the next Trump, to be honest. Just hoping for another election, maybe.
Horrified. Who do you think two huge powers run by these white men with blonde floppy hair who don't really care what they say so long as it's a popular opinion?
I think it's quite sad for our country, to be honest with you. I think the people deserve the truth.
Many now will be watching where Johnson turns first. Which does he view as his closest ally, Europe or the United States? Donald Trump had openly supported Johnson's bid for Prime Minister, and today he tweeted his congratulations, proclaiming he will be great. Trump will be watching closely as Johnson deals with his most immediate crisis, a standoff with Iran over a British oil tanker seized by Iranian authorities. The country's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, today urged Johnson not to see Iran as an enemy.
I think it is very important for Boris Johnson, as he enters 10 Downing Street, to understand that Iran does not seek confrontation. Iran wants to have normal relations based on mutual respect.
Boris Johnson will have to make a quick decision on the team that will deal with the Iran crisis. Will he keep the man he beat in the party leadership race, Jeremy Hunt, in his position as Foreign Secretary? It's a decision he'll have to make in the coming days, now that he's won the leadership.
The campaign is over and the work begins.
And tomorrow, the man who once said, "I've got more of a chance of being reincarnated as an olive than becoming Prime Minister," will go to Buckingham Palace and be formally appointed Britain's new leader. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
There may be a new prime minister residing at 10 Downing Street, but there's at least one resident who's staying on, Larry the Cat. Catch the kitty lingering on the sidewalk at a Boris Johnson press scrum sometime soon. I mention Larry because some of us here in the World Newsroom have felines on our mind. Here's The World's Lucy Martirosian with more.
Forget Boris Johnson. The question I'm wondering about, is Larry the Cat declawed? I'm asking because New York just became the first state in the U.S. to officially ban the practice of declawing cats. And I wanted to know how the U.S. compares to the rest of the world, starting with the U.K. Prime Minister's housemate. You can imagine how surprised the press office at 10 Downing Street was today when I called to ask about Larry's claws. But with the new Prime Minister, they haven't gone back to me. So I called up International Cat Care, a feline charity in the UK, instead.
No, he definitely won't be declawed.
This is Claire Besant, the chief executive of International Cat Care. She confirmed that Larry the Cat is not and will not be declawed.
So he was a rehomed cat, an unwanted cat at one point who went into a a shelter and then was came from there, I think, to help keep the mice down as much as anything else. Yeah. I think they have mice.
That's Sarah Ellis, who also works at the charity.
He is number 10's cat, not the Prime Minister's cat, so I imagine he will be staying.
In the US, many of us keep our cats indoors, and that means a lot of us declaw our cats to protect our furniture. Whereas in the UK and much of Europe, cats generally spend more time outdoors, and they need their claws for hunting and self-defense. Sarah Ellis says most Brits wouldn't declaw their cats even if it weren't illegal.
I think a lot of UK citizens wouldn't necessarily know that it is a procedure that could be done.
No.
They wouldn't. There would be no demand from cat owners to the vets asking to have this procedure done, whereas I believe in the US there's more demand from owners. So there are many vets that don't necessarily want to do it because they recognise from welfare reasons it's not the right thing to do.
It's not just a claw that's being removed. Declawing means cutting to the first joint, removing some of the bone and nerve. Some experts compare it to cutting off a bit of your finger. Claire Besant says it's something that International Cat Care has been talking about since the 1950s.
We've been here since 1958, and I think as a charity, declawing was something which we came out against at a very early time, and I think perhaps quite a lot of the animal charities became very outspoken to try and get it changed. So we had a drive to do that.
And that drive is really just catching on in the U.S.
It's cruel. It's barbaric, it's inhumane, and it's unnecessary.
That's New York Assembly member Linda Rosenthal. She championed the anti-cat declawing legislation in her state. It took 5 years to pass, and she says it's still controversial. But several other states, including Massachusetts, are looking into following New York's lead. And that might be good news for cats around the country. For The World, I'm Lucy Martirosian.
From British cats to British birds, a feral colony of parakeets stirs up a lot of emotion among Londoners.
Well, we found the whole range from love to hate and sort of hope to fear. People projected their own values onto them very clearly.
The wild parakeets of London, where they came from and why they stay, they're ahead on the show later this hour.
In the latest season of the Things That Go Boom podcast, we explore why no one worries much about nuclear war anymore, and maybe why we should. Things That Go Boom unpacks the Iran nuclear deal, complete with secret missions, burial plots, a crying jag, and a false alarm about Armageddon. Things That Go Boom, a dramatic look at the 21st century nuclear threat. Get it where you grab your podcasts.
The Trump administration expands its own power to quickly deport some undocumented immigrants. We'll explain what that means and later meet one of the volunteers who monitor Iceland's glaciers.
When you have known these glaciers for such a long time, you know their story quite well.
Glacier keepers on the front lines of climate change. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. Effective today, the Department of Homeland Security has a new policy that could speed up deportations all over the U.S. Immigration officers are now allowed to deport undocumented immigrants without a court hearing or a review, unless the immigrant is able to demonstrate they've been in the country continuously for at least 2 years. This is a big change, according to Cesar Garcia Hernandez. He teaches law at the University of Denver and says this new policy is a dramatic expansion of previous deportation rules.
Until now, this policy had made it possible for federal government to deport people who were apprehended at or near or within 100 miles of the border and who couldn't convince an immigration officer that they'd been in the United States for more than 14 days. This new policy promises to expand that to the entire country and to folks who can't convince an immigration officer that they've been in the United States for at least 2 years. So it's a rather radical transformation of a policy that has been on the books for quite some time, but has never applied in anything reaching these proportions.
What do you think could be the practical implications of a policy like this? I mean, like, does this mean that people now have to carry their documents with them at all times?
Yeah, it certainly means that if you're concerned about being apprehended by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, that you would be wise to carry proof of your residence in the United States for at least those last 2 years, so leases and medical records, whatever it is that you can bills from utilities, anything that they can show that you've been living in the United States for at least 2 years so that you can escape this quick procedure. It's to be clear, it doesn't mean that you're going to be immune from immigration law enforcement. It only means that you will be able to get your day in front of an immigration judge where then you can determine whether you're going to hire a lawyer who's going to help you figure out whether there's some legal basis for you to remain in the country. But that time is quite essential. And it's that time, that hearing before an immigration judge, that the expedited removal procedure eliminates from the scheme that many folks will likely face if this new policy goes into effect today.
Given the haste that this new policy suggests for deportation, are you expecting actual legal residents, people who are documented, to get caught up in this and get deported?
There's almost no question that lawful permanent residents, so people who we refer to as green card holders, are going to be mistaken for not having the authority to be in the United States. And there's very little doubt in my mind that United States citizens will too. Lots of folks who are U.S. citizens do not know that they are U.S. citizens. That's a technical legal determination that for many folks is actually quite murky. And I think this policy, if it's expanded to the entire country and for this two-year period, is going to catch many more U.S. citizens than has been the case up until now.
You're based in Denver now, Cesar, but you grew up in a border town in Texas and had a law practice in McAllen, where fast-track deportations for unauthorized immigrants were happening already because of this 100-mile rule. What's been the impact there, and what could that mean for expansion to places like where you are now based in Denver?
Yeah, I think that what we're seeing today is that the new normal for the United States is what has been the old normal for communities along the southwestern border for quite some time now. And this implementation is the tension that comes with it is perhaps a welcome because this a fear that immigration officers, whether it's Border Patrol agents or Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers, might suddenly show up and apprehend somebody and pluck them out of their community and throw them into deportation proceedings and get deported before anyone knows what's going on, has been a very real fear of immigrant communities along the border since going back to 2004. And so there is a perverse quality to this expansion that was announced this week in that maybe this will get the attention of folks in other parts of the country who have some more resources to try to challenge this kind of overreach.
President Trump announced this new fast-track removal policy just yesterday. How is the administration able to make changes that are so unprecedented, so sweeping? Like, what do executive orders allow for?
The Trump administration is pointing to authority granted by a law that Congress enacted back in 1996. And it's true that that law does say that it can apply to folks who have not been in the United States for at least 2 years and who don't have authority to be here. Now, the way that the government has applied it has been to say, look, we're going to apply in a much more limited fashion. And anytime that we want to change the way we're applying it, we'll issue a notice. Now, the question is the notice that was issued today, with such a radical transformation in the reach of this policy, is that sufficient? And I expect a legal challenge that's going to put that question front and center. And so we'll see the courts become involved in this latest immigration law enforcement initiative by the Trump administration, just like we've seen going back to the earliest days of the administration.
Cesar Garcia Hernandez teaches law at the University of Denver. Good to have you with us today. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure.
U.S. sanctions have been squeezing Iran's economy, cutting it off from most economic activity with the rest of the world. So some Iranians are turning to an alternative way to stay solvent, Bitcoin. But creating Bitcoin or mining Bitcoin relies on a lot of computers and lots of electricity. And now the Iranian government says it's going to regulate how Bitcoin is mined. At least that's allegedly the plan. Some say it's just a rumor. Zia Sadr is a Bitcoin enthusiast based in Tehran. He says a surge in the value of the cryptocurrency is one reason there's a Bitcoin boom in Iran.
Everyone in the crypto space globally knows that when Bitcoin price goes up, there would be a lot of attention. So basically, one of the most important things that we should consider is the price surge, which is followed by user surge. So this is what matters. But there are a couple of other reasons which are people are getting to know more and more about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies here in Iran. And with the cheap electricity here in Iran, it's very profitable to do mining.
So if rumor actually does become fact, like there is regulation on Bitcoin in Iran, what would that do to people who are currently mining Bitcoin?
I think that it would be better for them because the current state is very risky for them, and it's very costly at the same time. So regulations would mean two things mainly. It would be like they would take the government would take taxes from them for importing devices or higher prices on electricity from miners also. So both of these prices would make sense to be paid by miners in return for a legal way and a risk-free way to do mining in Iran. So it would be good, actually, and I think it would be positive for them. But if it becomes something like giving permits and I don't know, some kind of special access to some people, then there would be a lot of corruption in this field. And that's not what we want here in Iran. For like most miners wouldn't want such a thing.
You've probably heard that there is a fear outside Iran that Iranians are using Bitcoin precisely to get around U.S. sanctions. I guess what I'm asking, do you think Bitcoin is kind of the magic balloon that will float the finances of some Iranians right through U.S. sanctions?
Well, for some, yes. For some, no. So for people and small businesses, it would be good. And for some who would be like very big corporations and government departments and all of them, they cannot use it because of price volatility and also because of the transparency of the network. The Bitcoin network is very transparent. So if I was a government department, I wouldn't use Bitcoin because it would give me away at the moment that I use it. So that's one reason that they won't use Bitcoin for evading sanctions or anything.
Venezuela, you may know, tried to use cryptocurrencies to spur their own slipping economy. That didn't quite work for them. Do you think Bitcoin, do you think cryptocurrencies, even with regulation by the government in Iran, has a future there?
Yes, definitely. Because, like, you cannot regulate Bitcoin. It's very difficult. You can regulate businesses, but you cannot regulate Bitcoin. You can regulate, like, businesses to not work with Bitcoin, but it's very easy to go around that. So if needed, it will be used.
Bitcoin enthusiast Zia Sadr, based in Tehran. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Visit the central highlands of Iceland next month, and where there was once an active flow of ice, you will find a plaque, a memorial, really, to a former glacier lost to climate change. The demise of the Oikkal Glacier was carefully documented by volunteers who track Iceland's glaciers, work that has taken on more urgency with climate change. About 35 volunteer glacier keepers collect data at 64 measurement sites. Their numbers are published in the Icelandic scientific journal, Jokul, and submitted to the World Glacier Monitoring Service database. Snævarr Guðmundsson is a glaciologist at Southeast Iceland Nature Research Center and one of the glacier keepers. He joins us now. Snævarr, what does it mean to be a glacier keeper exactly? What does a glacier keeper do?
It actually means that you take care of maybe a single glacier and you measure it, hopefully annually, and then we collect these data. We've done it since 1930s. So we have a good record of how the glacier has been changing.
So you say you've been successful at monitoring glaciers, but is it possible that glacier keepers can actually keep glaciers from being lost or even retreating?
No, nothing like that. This is, you know, this is a global scale issue, but not something that any person can handle. I can tell you one thing to paint a picture of that. One of the larger glaciers I'm monitoring, is actually losing mass on such scales that it is losing about, let's say, you know, if you picture a container, a 20-foot container, this glacier, this single glacier, is losing one container of ice every second.
Wow.
And has been doing so for the last 120 years.
I mean, at some point, it's also possibly going to mean you won't have a job if these glaciers keep melting.
I
mean,
yeah.
I'm glad you're laughing about that, but isn't that the reality?
It is possible, yeah, but not in the next 200 years or so.
Snævarr, what drove you to do this work?
Well, actually, I've been fascinated by glacier since I was 12 years old.
In what the beginning,
climbing. I love climbing, and I loved climbing on the outlet glaciers, on the ice. So I just had a passion for it for a very long time.
Snavar, when you're out there documenting how these glaciers are changing so radically, what are you thinking about in terms of ways we should be combating climate change?
I think about this as a very serious problem we are heading into. I don't have the answer, actually, but I'm afraid that all nations on Earth must collaborate in doing something, but you can't do it as a single nation or a single person.
The former Okyokul Glacier, which lost its status as a glacier in 2014, it's being memorialized next month, as I said. How do you feel about that? Do you worry that some of the glaciers you're tracking right now may cease being glaciers at some point as well?
Yeah, it might. This is a very symbolic event, I think. This is one of the glaciers that I read about when I was a young boy. It's like a relative is dying. This is what will happen, and it will probably get faster and faster.
So not to be grim or extend that metaphor, I mean, as more glaciers melt, do you feel like you're losing a family?
When you have known these glaciers for such a long time, and you know their story quite well, you know which glacier was advancing at time and retreating at some time, you know when there was an eruption in this glacier. Yes, you are losing part of our geological story.
In Iceland, there are about 35 volunteers who are glacier keepers. Do you get together? I mean, when you do get together, what do you talk about?
Yes, we meet occasionally. We talk about just things like glaciers and anything else.
How do you keep conversation from getting to be a complete bum out?
Well, we don't have a sad conversation about this, actually. We know what is happening, and we don't have to discuss it much. The advice is to work this through. As I said earlier, we almost join forces together.
Snavar Gudmundsson is a glaciologist at Southeast Iceland Nature Research Center and one of the glacier keepers on the front line of glacial melt. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Our thanks to writer Gloria Dickey for help in reporting that story. Let me take a minute now to preview a story you'll hear tomorrow on The World. It starts here. That's Puerto Rican singer Ile. She's joined the protest calling for Puerto Rico's governor to step down. And she says it's been a long time coming.
Something very weird is happening, but it feels good. And we're just living the moment and enjoying the adrenaline and finally showing all the anger that we have inside of us.
Singer Ile, her music, and her island. A conversation about Puerto Rico. That's tomorrow here on the show. A famous pyramid in Egypt has just opened up for tourists for the first time in decades. I'm talking about the so-called Bent Pyramid just outside Cairo. If you don't know it, it was built for the pharaoh Sneferu about 46,000 years ago. And it's called the Bent Pyramid because, well...
it is bent.
That's Salima Ikram. She's an Egyptologist at the American University in Cairo. She spoke originally to the CBC's As It Happens. And she's got more to say about pharaoh Sneferu.
Debate about Sneferu because he actually has four pyramids.
So this is really cool, this story. You might think of the pyramids as this incredible engineering marvel that the Egyptians one day just dropped on the world. But it was really a process of trial and error. Sneferu tried four times to build a pyramid. The first attempt didn't turn out so well. It collapsed. The Bent Pyramid was attempt number two, but the structure started to crack. So the architects had to course correct at the top.
It goes up at one angle, and then it suddenly changes its course, giving a bend in its profile.
That didn't quite work as intended either. Then Sneferu built a smaller pyramid, and finally the Red Pyramid, which was perfect. And the three famous pyramids at Giza, those were built by Sneferu's son, grandson, and great-grandson based on his designs. So why is the Bent Pyramid opening up again now? Salima Ikram says the Egyptian government is hoping to boost tourism.
After 2011, we had a massive dip in tourism. So they're opening up new sites that have never been open properly for tourists before. So it's really exciting because people will have the chance of going in here. And apart from a few archaeologists, no one's really been in there for the past 80, 90 years.
Ikram mentioned 2011 there. That would be the year of the Arab Spring. It's been tense in Egypt pretty much ever since. If now still doesn't seem like the right time to visit the Bent Pyramid, you could always take a virtual visit.
This is where my quest began. Someone has taken great care of this chamber.
The Bent Pyramid is featured in the popular video game Assassin's Creed. The only problem? The game does not allow you to just walk into the pyramid. You have to break in first. Finally today, a mystery at the center of London, a loud one. A colony of parakeets has taken over the British capital, feral parakeets. These small green birds originate in South Asia and Central Africa. Nobody knows exactly how they got to London. So are they pesky intruders or an unofficial city mascot? Brenda Salinas looks into that.
All over the world, people keep parakeets as pets. There are dozens of YouTube videos about how to properly care for your parakeet. And yes, parakeets are a type of parrot.
But they are considered one of the more easy parrots to take care of. However, they are still very intelligent.
But in London, if you want to play with a parakeet, skip the pet store and go straight to a park.
In the morning is best to come and feed them, and they're friendly, but they can get a little bit aggressive if you run out of food.
Alicia McCauley moved to London a year ago and goes to Hyde Park every week to feed parakeets. They're landing on her arms, her shoulders, even her head as we talk.
Well, I love birds, and I think it's just really awesome to hang out with them and feed them, and yeah, it's just something fun to do in the city that you don't find anywhere else, really, and they're wild.
Nick Hunt has lived in London a lot longer than Alicia, and he realized that the parakeets were getting louder.
So in the time I'd been in London, which is about 9 years, parakeets had colonized the whole city, having started like 9 years before in southwest London.
He teamed up with photographer Tim Mitchell to chronicle how Londoners feel about the birds. Their book is called The Parakeeting of London.
Well, we found the whole range from love to hate and sort of hope to fear. People projected their own values onto them very clearly.
But before we get to that, let's get to the mystery. How did more than 32,000 parakeets get to be in London in the first place?
There's a lot of urban legends told about these birds.
There's the Jimi Hendrix theory.
He is rumoured to have appeared on Carnaby Street with a cage in his hands and released a breeding pair of ringneck parakeets, Adam and Eve, and they soared away into the sky, and that's where the whole thing started.
But Hendrix wasn't known to keep parakeets. There's also the theory that the birds escaped from the set of the 1950s film The African Queen.
You are a liar, Mr. Allnut. And what is worse, you are a coward.
Ooh! Coward yourself!
Photographer Tim Mitchell thinks that one is bogus, too.
We've fastidiously watched that film, and there's not a single parakeet in it, for a start.
The true origin story, significantly less dramatic, the social birds probably escaped from cages and adapted to the city. That's happened in many other places around the world, like Brussels and San Francisco.
Geographically, they have a really broad range. So, you know, they could cope with the diversity of the UK climate. And we love trees, and we have loads and loads of trees in the cities in this country.
Pubs, rugby clubs, and even a local craft brewery have adopted the feral parakeet as a London mascot. But some Londoners just see them as an invasive species.
People who don't like them will say they're a threat to native British birds.
The parakeets compete with smaller native birds for resources like nests. But so far, the government has decided not to cull them.
And it was sort of dawned on us that the threat isn't from native British birds, it's from native British people. It's from human activity. The reason why, you know, kingfishers and woodpeckers are in decline isn't to do with a few tens of thousands of parakeets, it's habitat loss and climate change and pollution and God knows what else that we're doing, not them.
London's parakeets also benefit from the warming climate.
So we got into some interesting thoughts and conversations about the meaning of what is native. Does it even make sense in an age where, you know, the climate is shifting to have this idea of native, because different jellyfish are appearing in our waters, different insects. Does that mean that they're not meant to be here? I mean, this is where this band of climate is where they live.
No matter how they came to be in London, feral parakeets are likely here to stay and squawk.
So maybe native isn't where you're from, but where you thrive.
Where you thrive. Yeah, that's a nice... I like that.
Yeah.
Where you thrive, that's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah.
For the world, Brenda Salinas, London.
Those parakeets are wild, but they seem to like humans. One of them also perched on top of Brenda's head while she was reporting this story. Check out Brenda, microphone in hand, as she communes with the birds. That's at theworld.org. That's it for us today. The World's theme music was composed by Ned Porter. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.